Thanks for tuning in. Just a quick note before we get started. This show is not intended as medical or legal advice. While we do our best to research, the views expressed by the host and guests are opinions and should not be taken as fact. Our goal is to inspire hope by sharing the personal stories of autism pioneers who make exceptional contributions to the autism community.
Did you ever wonder if all families living with autism are pioneers, forging a unique and sometimes challenging journey into each simple everyday of life? Join Erica Daniels, mother of a teenager living with autism, as she explores conversations with those pioneering the unpredictable work, lives, and journeys of people making a difference for families meeting the everyday challenge of living with autism.
Welcome to Hope Grows, the podcast. I'm Erica Daniels, host and founder of Hope Grows for Autism. I want to do a little bit something different for the next episodes, and we are going to be having a pediatric physician roundtable, and we're going to be discussing cannabis as a frontline solution for autism symptoms, and we're going to hear from three of the leading pediatric autism specialists in the country. Dr. Wendy Ross is a developmental and behavioral pediatrician. She's the inaugural director of Jefferson University Hospital's Center for Autism and Neurodiversity. Dr. Bonnie Goldstein is a licensed physician and owner of Canna Centers Wellness, a medical practice devoted to educating and improving qualifying patients for cannabis treatment. Dr. Alan Flashman is a practicing psychiatrist based in Israel with a specialty in adult, child, and adolescent family treatment. You might recognize these guests and physicians from previous episodes, and I highly recommend listening to each one because they all have their unique perspective. But today, together, we hear them join forces to advocate and educate about autism and about cannabis as a frontline solution. Thanks for tuning in. And hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. I'm Erica Daniels, founder of Hope Grows for Autism and mother of a teenager who is on the autism spectrum and has been using medical cannabis for about 7 years now. Thanks, everybody, for being here. And I look forward to our discussion and sharing of ideas and really making this our first kind of official pediatric physician roundtable that talks about the potential for cannabis as a frontline solution for symptoms associated with autism. Dr. Ross, you want to tell us about yourself?
So I am a developmental and behavioral pediatrician, which means that I did medical school, and then I did a 3-year residency in pediatrics, and then a 3-year subspecialty fellowship in behavior and development, seeing kids with intellectual and developmental disabilities and helping to integrate their medical, educational, and therapeutic plans so things were not a la carte for the families.
Dr. Goldstein?
I trained as a pediatrician as well. And after residency, I went into the field of pediatric emergency medicine for about 13, 14 years. And took a leave of absence because I was working at night and taking care of a young child during the day. And during that time, someone asked me about medical cannabis and I didn't know a thing. So I started educating myself and I switched careers in 2008 and became a cannabis physician. I started seeing adults mostly at the time here in California. And subsequently, after the CNN documentary that featured a little girl with Dravet syndrome, a severe pediatric epilepsy, I was inundated with requests to see pediatric patients for medical cannabis and have since seen probably close to 2,000 patients at this point for pediatrics, mostly children with epilepsy, autism, both diagnoses sometimes, and numerous other diagnoses like cancer or other GI conditions, lots of different genetic syndromes. And it's been now about 15 years that I've been in this field.
I'm Alan Flashman. I trained in pediatrics. Then I did adult psychiatry in order to do child psychiatry. When I was finished with 6 years of that, the neurosurgeon said, 6 years. I'm operating the brains. We go playing with children. So that's that's how I get along with neurosurgeons. Anyway, after I finished training, which was a long time ago, I moved to Israel 40 years ago. I live in the south in the capital of nowhere. And my practice, basically, I came to do academic medicine and ran away from that very quickly. Ended up doing primary care, mental health. Mental health is never exactly primary care. It's also secondary. And the brave women, the two mothers in Israel who discovered medical cannabis, literally dragged me into it. They said, "You're coming to Tel Aviv to talk to us, and we'll tell you why." And they told me why. And they didn't have another doctor to, in Israel, it was very primitive. You had to get a license for CBD. So, you know, we're way behind California, where Bonnie was able to get started early. My first adult case was in 2009. And that was also an adult with post-trauma who dragged me into it. But these women dragged me into it about 7 or 8 years ago. Since then, I've probably seen between 1,000 and 1,500 kids. I doubt as intensively as Bonnie has seen them, but they've passed through, and I guess a light kind of follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you. And Dr. Ross, why don't you start off? Share kind of your perspective on medical cannabis, how that fits into your practice or doesn't, and kind of the challenges and the benefits that you're experiencing regarding that.
So to get started, I just want to share a little bit of a personal story. And I think this is a place where a lot of us who don't have experience with cannabis as a treatment find ourselves, who grew up in my generation, is that I must have had either a conscious or unconscious bias about cannabis. I had never personally used cannabis. And my first real exposure to it was when my husband had terminal cancer and was using cannabis. And I began to realize just how helpful it was in terms of reducing anxiety, in terms of increasing appetite, improving sleep. And I think I mentioned that not to overshare, but to say that having that lived experience really opened my eyes to the therapeutic benefits of cannabis and really shifted my perspective. So I think it was critical for me to have had that experience. And as a developmental pediatrician, particularly with my pediatric patients with autism, a lot of times they have a lot of very aggressive, inexplicable behaviors. And if I cannot attribute them to something like a comorbidity like ADHD or anxiety, which frequently happens, if I find myself in a position where I'm reaching for something like an atypical antipsychotic, like risperidone or aripiprazole, which are actually the only two FDA-approved medications for autism, that's where I take a pause and I think about cannabis, especially because those medications have just this horrible metabolic triad of obesity, hypertension, diabetes. And I think that's frequently where I find myself beginning to consider cannabis as an option. And in my experience, has been a little bit mixed, but I've had huge success using CBD, CBD-THC combinations for that group.
I know that, Dr. Flashman, you have a, do you want to comment on that or share your thoughts?
I'll tell you what my experience is and how I think about it. First of all, this is, I think, important for parents of children with autism. This idea of aggressive or rage attacks, I always ask myself, who are they angry at? I don't see it as rage. And I began to realize that there's an enormous amount of frustration. And at this point, when I would be seeing kids, a lot of the kids that I would be seeing either had taken the so-called atypical antipsychotics, which as a psychiatrist, they were a great blessing until they became a huge curse by being overused. But, you know, when they came in, risperidone was showed up in 1990, it was a huge improvement over Haldol. And you may or may not know that it was done by the same person, the same biochemist, actually worked on Haldol and then tweaked it for 20 years and came up with this risperidone. It's an unusual story. Janssen from the drug company. But if you look at autism, I don't know really, you know, whether it really is indicated, because the results that I tended to see would shut things down, because it really shut, it turns off the switch of a lot of the brain, you know, by blocking dopamine. And aside from the metabolic triad, my impression was that it was turning the kids off. In other words, it was making the environment a little easier, but it wasn't really helping them to become themselves. It was sort of keeping them from becoming anybody, just be quiet. And I didn't really like that, you know, as a psychiatrist. So my impression was that cannabis was much better. And almost all of the kids, not all, but almost all of the kids that I've seen who were on medication stopped the medication. If they had a good effect with cannabis, what I generally did, you know, people would come and say, can you stop the medication? I'd say, no. First, we're going to add the cannabis. I have never seen any bad interactions. Let's get a good solid result with the cannabis and optimize it. And then, you know, risperidol is murder to get off of it. It has to be done very, very slowly. And otherwise, what people would do is they would stop the risperidol and start the cannabis, and the kid would be going crazy. And they'd say, see, cannabis is driving them crazy. It was because of stopping the risperidol was driving them crazy. So I'm very careful about that. So I figure another 6 months of risperidol isn't the end of the world, but having the whole cannabis business mucked up, you get one trial. In Israel, if you do cannabis and anybody has any idea that it might not be perfect, so then that's it. Everybody, you know, throws it in the garbage and says, oh, another crazy doctor doing weird things. I would say, though, about medications that I'm interested to hear what Bonnie thinks, too. The kids that I see get what all American children seem to get in their mother's milk these days, which is Prozac, Risperidol, and Ritalin. My impression is that if there's a mood problem, it's part of the spectrum. If there's an attention problem, I haven't seen a kid on the spectrum that hasn't had an attention problem. So I tend to think that it's all part of the spectrum. And I would say in my experience that almost all the kids, Ritalin has not been exactly, you know, a home run. Cannabis has been better. I'd say 1 in 20, it seems, you know, that comorbidity word, which I don't like very much, because sometimes it means we don't know. But there are some kids who are Ritalin responsive in addition to cannabis. But the way I see it, you first start first. That's what I think. You first start with cannabis. And when you get a good CBD result, if you have other problems, you can try to use, you know, some things to try to help them. Going the other way, I think, is, I would say, you know, at this point, there's enough experience in the three of us and the person who's not here to say it probably isn't right to start other medications before cannabis. I think cannabis has a much better chance. If you just say risk-benefit, likelihood of success, I think cannabis has a much better profile than anything else for autistic kids. And, you know, we're really trained that we want children to start with the thing with the best profile. Just because it's called cannabis is not a good reason to give them things that have a much worse profile. But I'm interested to hear what Bonnie's experience is too.
Well, thank you for that. I agree with just about everything you said. Most of the patients that come to me are either on medication already, and cannabis is kind of a last resort, or they've been offered medication and the parents are second guessing that and trying to see if cannabis. So I'm now getting, it used to be more so kids on medication, and now it's definitely more so parents questioning it. And I think that's just because of groups like Hope Grows and some other groups that are out there providing resources. I think one other thing that hasn't been touched on yet is about, not only do these medications, as you said, Dr. Flashman, that they just turn the switch off for these children, right? They're to treat the irritability associated with autism. That's what the FDA says. They're not addressing the core symptoms. And I have to tell you that in my experience with these patients, seeing now many, many children with autism, is what I am seeing and what the parents are reporting is improvement in core symptoms, ability to socialize better, less repetitive behaviors, less over-focus on one thing. It's not perfect, but cannabis is starting to actually, what I can see, it seems to open up the brain and allow these children to have some breakthroughs. And I know, Erica, with Leo, you've probably seen some of this in your own experience, and that's probably what drove you to create Hope Grows for Autism, right? So that's what's exciting to me, is that it's not just calming the aggression. It's not just making the child sleep at night or try new foods. It's actually allowing that child to potentially reach and achieve things that maybe nobody thought they could ever achieve. I have parents that report to me, I can't believe the school is giving me this feedback. Now, maybe at home, because the child has a comfort level at home and they're being a little more aggressive, I have some parents that say, parenting this child is very difficult, but at school, the child is getting great reports. They're paying attention, they're interacting, they're following instructions, they're not having outbursts. They're moving from activity to activity without that difficulty with transition. So I think that, and I agree that certainly we have enough safety data on cannabis. Not only do we have thousands of years of people using it, but now we have a number of reports in the scientific literature, really just since about 2017, 2018, that show not only is there endocannabinoid system dysfunction, but that when you use cannabis, even if you don't get a great outcome, it's still safe and well tolerated. And that is so important to me. I have used now, in addition, everybody's talking about CBD, and I think CBD is great, but we have to remember, as Dr. Meshulam in Israel says, it's a treasure trove of compounds. I've been using, and because I'm in California, we have the freedom to do this. I've been using, of course, THC. I've been using CBG, cannabigerol. I've been using CBDA, which is the raw form of CBD. I've been using THCA, which not only helps with symptoms of autism, but I have a number of kids who did not respond to CBD for seizure control who are seizure-free on THCA, which is the raw form of THC, right? And then also just recently, CBDV, cannabidivarin, came on the market. And it is extremely exciting to me because this compound, which I have now started in a handful of kids, remember, I've been following kids now going on 10 years. Some of them only had partial response. They're not full responders. Not everybody is a full responder to really any drug, right? We have now a handful of patients in my practice who are going longer than they've ever gone without seizures, but also I started using it in autism in some of the kids who wear CBD and THC helped, but again, didn't give a full response, or let's just say there's still room for improvement. And we are seeing less aggression, less impulsivity, better eye contact, better socialization. I'm getting emails saying, oh, the school reached out to me and said, after 1 month on CBDV, what are you doing? He's a completely different child. And that's a child already on cannabis. One thing that I find too, that I think everybody needs to be open to, is the layering of cannabinoids. So sometimes it's CBD and CBG, sometimes it's CBG and THC. And it's important to understand that we're not just throwing these out as cannabis physicians. We understand where these cannabinoids work now. We may not know everything, but we understand mechanism of action. We understand targets, meaning when you take CBG, it's not magic in your body. It has certain targets where it binds, certain targets where it blocks. These are very important things to understand because that's how we understand pharmaceuticals to work, right? It targets a dopamine receptor, or it targets a serotonin receptor, or the serotonin itself. It's the same thing with cannabinoids. They're not magic. They have targets. One thing that I have found interesting, just my last point here, is that I think that because cannabinoids are what we call promiscuous, are promiscuous in the way they work in the body. And what I mean by that is they're not very selective. They hit multiple targets. For some patients, I have found that may not work well. We may hit a serotonin receptor when we don't need to. It's too much for that patient. Right. And part of what's missing is, of course, the understanding where that child is coming from, what their brain chemistry is. We're kind of blanketing everybody, at least in my practice. I try to be very thoughtful about, okay, what are the main issues with the child, which cannabinoid? But I explain to the family, and luckily it's not like Israel here, which is if CBD doesn't work in this particular ratio, we're going to try something else. And if that doesn't work, we're going to try something else. And if I feel that if I explain that in the beginning, when I first start with a family, they're willing to go the mile, the extra mile, really, to just, you know, kind of rule it in and rule it out. And Wendy, you mentioned my book. That's what I write in my book, rule it in or rule it out. This particular compound either suits you or it doesn't. If it suits you, we're going to figure out what dose. And then if there's room for improvement, we layer on another. And most of my patients, believe it or not, are layering. And I also find you can use lower doses, so it's less costly.
I just want to say, Bonnie, I mean, that doesn't sound much different than how we want to prescribe any kind of psychiatric medication for children is that we want to set expectations, and there's some degree of, I don't want to say educational guessing, but it's trial and error to some extent, right? So I wouldn't judge the cannabinoids on the need to sort of try different things, because I don't really think it's any different than any other treatment that we use, right?
I agree with you. And that's what I tell the parents after they've come in and they have 15 drugs listed. And I say, so you see this list? That was all trial and error. That's what we're going to do for another year. But hopefully, and the beauty of cannabis is if it doesn't suit you, you don't have this long weaning period. As the other doctor mentioned, there's this, you know, to get a child off an addictive drug can take a long time. And so often what I tell patients is let's add the cannabis first. Let's get you sorted out even a little bit better. 80% better, 30% better, and then we can start weaning. And that's one of the first questions, too, is if it's not working, but we're stuck on it, when can we get off of it? And I always tell people, put the brakes on that. Let's first try to make your child have a better quality of life, at least a little bit first. What if we could just get work on sleep or on the aggression, right? We kind of pick different things and or symptoms, and we try to address that. And, you know, I've met people, and I know the two of you have as well, who, you know, I had someone recently in my office, we haven't slept in 7 years. And I feel so badly for those people. Or they send the other children to grandma's house so that the kids can get a good night's sleep there. I know you will both have, you're both shaking your heads. You've heard this. It can be so difficult to have a child who really is not responding to treatment and is just day to day, basically, you know, like trying to put a fire out. And it just affects the whole family. And that's where cannabis can be so, even if it just gives you everybody a good night's sleep, you've already made a big impact on the family.
Trulieve believes in providing leading information backed by experts, as well as a model for compassionate care, the foundation of the medical marijuana mission, and are committed to educating not only patients and the public, but also physicians. Trulieve partners with qualified physicians across all of our states to supply education, resources, and industry insight to empower the patient base. Through these partnerships, we are moving the industry forward and ensuring patients have access to high quality, safe, and reliable medicine.
I might add that the idea of trial and error, I see as a way of making a partnership with the family. In other words, it's not my trial and error. If the kid is over 8, it's his trial and error. If he's under 8, then it's he with his parents. But, you know, I usually would tell a kid, look, if your name is Joey, the point of this treatment, that's really true of any treatment, is it should be just greater to be Joey. That's the whole point. It should be just great to be Joey. And, you know, the spirit all makes you a little less Joey. The idea is to be you and to become more you as much as you can. You know, there, I think, when you're saying, Bonnie, you know, that you don't always get everywhere. Let me float two ideas that I wanted to know how the two of you would think about, because I never get a chance to talk with other doctors about this. One idea is, as I started to use the CBD, and in Israel we used it with 1% THC because there wasn't any pure CBD. Now, a year ago, CBD pure became legal. And so now I don't bother with the license, and I start with just pure CBD. But the results are not yet in. But I would be doing this. There was this one paper that suggested that, you know, there's a rigidity in the brain in moving between default and resting the default state and executive state. The way that the brain, that's the latest in brain science, that the brain really works like energy. You know, it's all the things from different patterns. And then the different patterns, you have to go from one to the other, because if you can't go from inside to outside freely and quickly, you get stuck. So I had the impression that a lot of these so-called rage attacks are really frustration attacks. In other words, that the kid, the world was asking him to do something he just couldn't do. And what he needed to do was to sort of do what in the psychoanalytic literature is referred to as going into a shell. And you create a shell by banking on something and making it the largest organ of your body, the skin, do something to your thalamus to just relieve some sort of frustration. So I would do this, you know, in general. And then every now and then I would talk to parents, and they had one of these little geniuses, you know, because some of our autistic kids are also these little geniuses. I would tell the parents, you know, this is the inside and outside of it. You know, maybe it makes it more flexible. And these kids would say, how did you know that? That's what it is. So that doesn't happen very often. It made me think more and more about brain flexibility, to the point that at this point, I think that the future of autism is really as a set of difficulties with brain flexibility. As the two of you probably know, the term autism, we're even talking about the communication, is old stuff. And it began with blaming mother, and it began with the fact that a baby is autistic, and then you gradually grow to communication. And so everything is regression. I mean, nobody thinks that now. So, you know, we're stuck with this old term. I think that brain flexibility is probably more to where we're going for the future. And I think we'll find, as the fMRI will give us, instead of two states, 20 states, and how you move between the states, my guess is that we'll see a bunch of different kids, and then we can find out when CBD and so forth. The other idea I wanted to float is I'm not a big fan of reductionist pharmacology. I think that it gets us to a certain point, and it doesn't let us go beyond it. And the reason I say that is because, you know, the two of you may know that when a dinosaur like me was being trained in psychiatry, everybody knew that there was one transmitter that was the problem. And everybody knew that it worked like, guess what, like the stock market, too much, too little. And that was norepinephrine. Norepinephrine. Everything was norepinephrine. It went up, it went down, up, manic, down, depressed. Everybody know, one. And then the pills were really very dangerous. A two-week handful would cause cardiac arrest. So we used to give people 3 days at a time if there was suicide. It was a total nightmare. And then because Elavil put people to sleep, the drug companies figured out that this is a good sleeper. Let's go look at serotonin for sleep. And they created Prozac for sleep. And everybody was, you know, surprised. That would have made a scientist and not a drug company say, it's not just noradrenaline. So it's also serotonin. Why would nature choose one horse? Nature doesn't ever do that. So it must be a balance. And then there's another 38 or more transmitters. So let's look at the balance between the transmitters. But unfortunately, that was before there were computers, and that would have been too complicated. So we just said it's serotonin. Suddenly, it isn't noradrenaline, it's serotonin. It's one of the least scientific moves that I've ever experienced. Of course, then, you know, there were some that also do noradrenaline. But the issue is, I think, balances. The idea I wanted to float with you is that when we talk about the cannabinoids and the endocannabinoids, I would like us to think about the balance between them. See, I think that you're sort of seeing that with the layering, and that it's not CBD does this or C, you know. And sometimes when I saw the kids, I would see that some of them, I'd say one in seven that I saw, needed THC. CBD actually made them a little bit less, more jumpy. And so I thought that, you know, the CBD THC receptors, but it's more complicated than that. You know more of the complication than I do, that they have to be balanced. And some people have too little CBD, probably 6 or 7 out of 8. So you give them CBD. Some of them have probably, you know, they're unbalanced, they need more THC because those kids seem to do well with THC. So that's the idea. That's just an idea. So what do you folks think?
Well, I can comment. So we know that these, our endocannabinoids are biphasic in their properties, meaning low anandamide can be overstimulating and higher anandamide is more calming, and the cannabinoids work the same way. And I have definitely seen in my pediatric practice, and I see it in some of the articles too, that for some children, CBD is overstimulating. This is a very important thing to share with the family. I'm going to start at a low dose because we always start low and we titrate up. And if low dose overstimulates your child, we're going to go higher. And people say, what are you talking about? A little bit made my child run all around the house all night long, and now you want to give them more? And so people, it's very counterintuitive. But if you explain these biphasic properties, it becomes much easier to understand, okay, we're going to go higher. And when we go higher, sometimes we get that calming effect. I agree that some children absolutely need some THC. In one of the studies that came out of Israel, it looked like 50% of children responded to a 20 part CBD to 1 part THC ratio up to a certain point. And then half of the kids did not respond to that ratio. And they added in extra THC down to a ratio of 6 to 1. And another, I think, 33% responded. You're talking about close to 83% response rate. But this also goes to the idea of one size does not fit all, right? These kids are not the same. We check the box, autism spectrum, but they all have their own unique expression and manifestation of their difficulties. And I think that, again, the way that we have to address that is you have some clinical experience. When I have parents coming in who say the house is destroyed, we're at the point where we're afraid of our child, especially if it's a teenager getting bigger, we have to include some THC in there to help with some of that rage and that aggression in the beginning. It's not getting them high. I don't have any patients that are high. And I have to tell you, some of them are on really high dose THC that would put all four of us, if we shared the dose, under the table for about 3 days, yeah. Right? But they tolerate it. And why is that? And, you know, this is an oversimplification, but there appears to be this dysfunctional endocannabinoid system. And now we have 2 studies, one from Stanford, one from Israel, probably more in the works, looking at levels of anandamide, one of the main endocannabinoids. And these are low in children with autism. They are statistically significantly low to the point where it is now being floated as an idea that maybe anandamide levels are a biomarker of autism. And we don't need to wait till a child is 2.5 or 3 years old. When you have, and I'll never forget, this family came in, it was their 4th child. And the mother knew at 6 months that there was something different about this child. She was an experienced mother. And she said, this child's different. And she kept going back and forth to the pediatrician saying, is there any way you can test him? I know there's something going on. And sure enough, at 2.5, he was diagnosed, but she knew from very early on. And the reason to diagnose earlier, of course, I'm sure Wendy, you can attest to this, is to intervene earlier, right? And to hopefully try to get that balance back that we're talking about. Remember, these cannabinoids are homeostatic. They try, if something is elevated, it brings it down. If something's low, it brings it up. And we don't have pharmaceuticals that do that. That's where this botanical medicine is so very special, in that it can do that, because that's what our endocannabinoid system is doing. If it's okay, I'd like to mention just the research that I did with the pharmacometabolomics, if that's okay. So in this research I did, we collected, so the idea was to collect saliva from children with autism before their medical cannabis was given. And then at the time, it was about 1.5 to 2 hours when the parents reported, we start to see the medicine kicking in and we can actually see the benefits. And what we did was we collected saliva from 9 neurotypical children to establish a control level or a control range, physiologic range, we call it, of various biomarkers that are involved in aggression and pain and inflammation in children with autism. And so we had the children take their nighttime, and these were all children in the autism group that had already been treated for at least 1 year and had a steady regimen that was showing some improvement, whether it was CBD combined with CBG or whatever. And in the paper, it outlines the dosing. And if you take a look at it, you're going to say, there's nothing standard here. Every child is on their own regimen, but that's kind of how it goes. What we found was that in measuring the saliva before the medical cannabis dose in the morning after an 8-hour washout, and then measuring the biomarkers again at the 1.5 to 2 hour mark after, that if a child had an elevated level of a biomarker, it actually kind of trended towards the physiologic range. So came down, meaning the cannabis medicine kind of brought it down to closer to that physiologic range, if not in that physiologic range. And if it was too low, it brought it up, documenting that homeostasis, that ability to balance out those biomarkers. And what's interesting is that 94% of those biomarkers trended towards the physiologic range. That's a very high number. We also found that in looking at some of the baseline, we could determine, at least preliminarily, that who might benefit from cannabis and who might not benefit from cannabis, which I think would be very helpful, because I always feel bad for the families that come in who really don't find benefits. And I'm not sure if why they're not finding benefits, but I usually find it's more some of the mild cases of autism where the child's actually overall doing pretty well, but they just want to see if they could get some improvement. It seems to me, and I don't know if that's your experience, but it seems to me that some of those kids, just even on low dose, high dose, trying multiple different products, we don't really get anywhere. But maybe because there's nothing to fix, right? We think about that. And it does seem, though, that for many of the kids who have aggression, cannabis can really be the answer. And in our research, we found that we did an age range from 6 to 12, that the older kids who are probably likely getting into puberty seem to have some of the better results, which was really interesting to me. Now, of course, it was a small number. We had some limitations, of course, in the research, but we're excited because it looks like we're going to be doing a much larger group and it will be more robust. So we'll be able to really determine which biomarkers are significant, which biomarkers respond to which cannabinoids, and to hopefully have some objective way to measure benefits, who might benefit, and potentially, let's say someone gets a certain benefit, but they're, like I talk about, there's room for improvement. Can we use those biomarkers to help narrow in on what product or cannabinoid or terpene might be beneficial? So to help give a little less trial and error.
Yeah, that would be nice because it's very overwhelming from the family's perspective.
I just have a question. I mean, in my experience, some of my families, and if you could speak to this and explain it or help me understand or know what to do, where their child would be doing really well on a formulation, and then it's almost like they need to take a little break and then reset. I don't know if you guys can speak to that phenomenon.
Well, what I think is happening, and I don't know that we understand fully, but I think what's happening, you have to remember, if you're coming in when you first start cannabis with a dysfunctional endocannabinoid system, and I see this with many of my adult patients that I took care of and still take care of for many years, people who hang out with me for the last 15 years that I've been doing this, they want to stay in my practice, even though I'm a pediatrician. I hear all the time, oh, you know what? I just don't need as much, doc. And I think, oh, isn't that interesting? Part of it is you're upregulating the endocannabinoid system. So the tone gets better, right? So this improvement, and you just don't need as much. That's the one that makes the most sense. The other part of it too is there's one article out there from a number of years ago that does report what we call reverse tolerance potentially as a mechanism for CBD. So reverse tolerance, right? The opposite of tolerance where I need a higher dose to get the same effect. Reverse tolerance, I can get away with a lower dose to get the same effect. And part of that, I think that reverse tolerance is probably tied into that upregulation of the endocannabinoid system. And I see it in my epilepsy patients. I had a patient who was seizure-free on 8 mg/kg per day of a 25-to-1 CBD to THC for years. And out of the blue, seizures started. And I said to the mom, we're going to take a break. And she almost lost it. She's like, what do you mean? I'm not going off of this stuff. I said, look, I think after all this time, we're seeing upregulation. We're seeing balance, maybe healing. Who knows? Maybe he was going to outgrow his seizures anyway, right? None of us know that. He has an idiopathic seizure disorder. Cryptogenic, we don't know why. We slowly lowered. He's on 1 mg/kg per day. Again, still now going on, I don't know, 6 years seizure-free. And it was only these breakthroughs. And the response was to lower the medicine. Now, we don't find that with pharmaceuticals. But you have to remember, what is the underlying mechanism? And I think it's improved endocannabinoid tone. And also, I just want to say one thing. Children are moving targets. I always tell parents, we may find get to the Holy Land, but then it may change because they're going to hit puberty. They're going to grow. Children grow and change every day, and they're moving targets. So you have to kind of expect that we're not going to get them on a dose and keep them there and then never change it. That's just not going to happen. I haven't found anybody yet that has happened.
Well, I had one, you know, you're talking about the long term. I haven't had those experiences, but I don't have the experience that you have over time to be so precise with it. I have had sort of the usual pediatric experience that after 3 or 4 years, you need to raise the dose, you know, sort of linearly. That seems to happen. But there were some kids who about a month into it, suddenly they would respond, and then a month into it, they would stop responding. A month, 6 weeks. And one of the mothers who brought me into it is an excellent naturopath. And naturopaths have their own way of thinking, which we don't always find intuitive, but it may overlap with some of what you were just saying. She said, you have to take a break. But these kids were taking a lot of breaks. And my impression was that it wasn't in the endocannabinoid system, it was in the liver. In other words, that there was a balance in the liver. And that's about the time that it takes for the enzymes to sort of change. So if I saw somebody who was responding and then it's 4 to 6 weeks suddenly wasn't, I just increased the dose by 20%. And that seemed to solve it most of the time. And then it stayed the same. It didn't keep re-regulating. But did you have that experience too? That's a sort of a simple experience. But
absolutely. And sometimes it's hard to know. And I've been doing this a long time. It's still hard to know. Should I go up or should I go down? Is this endocannabinoid tone improvement, right? Upregulation of the endocannabinoid system, reverse tolerance? Or is the child, quote, outgrowing their dose? And that can sometimes be very difficult. But again, I think communication with the family is so key. If you explain, I'm not sure which way to go. Sometimes this happens with cannabis, that we have this situation. Or it could be that your child gained some weight or potentially is having some metabolism issues or just changes. And so usually what I will do is I will ask the parent, what do you feel comfortable doing? It's kind of a 50-50 toss sometimes. Now, sometimes if it's a high dose for a very long time and the child's doing really well, then I think it's upregulation and I will back down on the dose. But I always say we're going to think about either going up or going down. And again, I haven't really had anybody, I mean, I have seen honeymoon period, like what you explained, and that can definitely happen. And then of course, you know, so many of these kids are on other pharmaceuticals and we have the interaction with the cytochrome P450 system. We have interaction with the UGT, you know, elimination system as well, where CBD and THC both. And I have to say with some of the newer cannabinoids, or I should say more readily available now cannabinoids, they're not new, they've been around a long time. We don't have all the pharmacokinetics, so we don't know exactly what they might be interacting with. But I think part of it is always making sure the parent knows what to look for. And this is with any medication, right? We say, if you see this, you see sedation, if you see more agitation, you got to get in touch with me because we can change it. I find with cannabis in general, except for my cancer patients where I am treating them sometimes with very high doses and they just kind of have to accept the side effects the same way one accepts side effects with chemotherapy. In general, I tell parents there should not be side effects with cannabis medicine because usually we can dial in. You don't have to accept sedation. You don't have to accept poor appetite. We can change the dosing, change the product, change the timing to try to suit your child's response. And that's a little bit different, I think, than pharmaceutical, where I do have some families that come into my office and I can see they're on subtherapeutic doses of seizure medications and the seizures are out of control. I'm like, why are you giving this medicine? It's not in a therapeutic range. It's just kind of like you're giving it, but, and I understand because probably at a higher dose, their child was having side effects. So they lowered it. Oftentimes on their own. But at the same time, with cannabis, I have found that you don't really need to suffer through side effects. And it's interesting when you read the reports on cannabis, you'll see, oh, 25% of patients had side effects and they list it. And I think sometimes people think that that's what these families are living with. And I just want to put it on the record that they're not living with these side effects because we adjust the medication. In a trial, there is a goal and they have a protocol and it's very different than what we do in the real world. And someone may have had a side effect of sedation, even in a trial, they may adjust and then that it resolves, but it's still reported. And I just want to make sure people know that just because a side effect is reported in a study does not mean, like for instance, I just saw something, 27% of the kids in this particular autism study had side effects. I don't even kind of think about it as side effects. I think about, oh, we're just not at the right dose or it's not the right product. But I think side effects don't need to be part of it. And if you explain that to the families, and also I find that some families are comfortable if you give them a titration schedule, they will just go up and then report back. And it's not a medicine I'm worried about anybody having trouble with. What's the worst thing that's going to happen? I've had patients accidentally get too much. Grandma, instead of 0.2 mLs, gave 2 whole mLs. And what happened? I get a call. I reassure. I call in the morning to make sure the child's fine. What do I get? we had our best night's sleep ever, doctor. Can we go up on the dose? So sometimes a mistake is a good mistake. I just recently had a family who was on one particular oil, just started with me with autism. It's an 11-year-old, fairly aggressive, struggling at school, has been on, I think, 7 different medications, is on still on 3. And the oil that they ordered, which is a hemp-based oil through the mail, didn't show up on time. And the mom was running low. So she panicked. There's another oil that she can get at a local CBD store. I confirmed with her what it was and so on. Well, guess what? That oil works better for the child than the oil that she was ordering through the mail. So sometimes you get happy mistakes or happy errors or, you know, unintentional 20 different products to find it. And that's why I tell people it's going to take time. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. But I think most people are excited by using something natural and by having a low side effect profile.